Welcome to the Spectator Podcast. The world is adjusting to the news that Donald Trump has won the American presidential election. He's been in to see Barack Obama, he's been on the phone to Theresa May, and we're waiting now to find out who his cabinet's going to be and what the future might have in store. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by my colleague James Forsyth and by Tim Stanley in Washington. So Tim, I imagine there's been huge disbelief in the Washington press corps. Do you think people are beginning to work out what's happened yet, or is it still a bit of a mystery?
There's both disbelief and disappointment. On the night of the vote itself, I was in the Trump ballroom, and it was very telling that while the Trump supporters were obviously overjoyed, the members of the press looked astonished and flabbergasted. And I spoke to one young journalist, and I said, "What the hell has your country just done?" And he replied, "Well, your country did it first. It's called Brexit." There is a sense of shock, but people are starting to slowly go through the data. And I think the conclusion that they are reaching is that Hillary Clinton simply couldn't enthuse the Democratic base enough in order to win. The big story of this election is about motivation and turnout. Donald Trump managed to turn out enough Republicans just about to win. Hillary Clinton lost several million Democrat voters who came out for Barack Obama but didn't come out for her. So it really was an election that was won on negativity ratings, and people were just about more apathetic about her than they were disgusted with him.
James, I remember a quote from the Clinton campaign saying, "As soon as I hear a candidate talking about energizing his base, that's a campaign that's going down the toilet." Now, that rule has been jettisoned, as has much of the centrist politics of the last 15, 20 years. Is Donald Trump reinventing political debate and political style and combat in America?
Well, I think the fascinating thing about Donald Trump's victory is that he actually won by winning states that have been solidly Democrat, states that were in this supposed blue wall that Hillary Clinton had that was going to stop her from losing. I'm thinking of states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. So I think we can't see this as a kind of purely as a kind of base-driven campaign. But what I think you can see is that he has created a new Republican coalition appealing to voters in those kind of Rust Belt states who have traditionally backed Democrats, you know, classic kind of working class voters. I mean, there is something going on here, which is essentially this, which is people think the system doesn't work for them, and so they're going to vote to upend the system, however flawed the standard bearer of that cause is. I think it is, as Tim says, it is very striking that 65% of voters, according to the exit poll, have much you can believe that, didn't like either candidate. This is, I think, as Tim said, this was more of an anti-Clinton vote than a pro-Trump surge.
But, Tim, isn't it amazing that I don't think a single American national paper backed Donald Trump? Now, we're used to hearing about the influence of the press is blamed here for causing Brexit, but it's pretty difficult to blame the press for stirring up Donald Trump's support, unless you argue that the level of abuse that press gave to Trump ironically served to strengthen his credentials as the anti-establishment candidate.
The National Enquirer did endorse Trump, I think you'll find, which is the magazine that runs with stories like Elvis killed Princess Diana. So he did get that support. Perhaps the media's constant criticism of Trump counted against him. I'm not so sure it did. I think that what happened is that voters rationalized that both candidates are as bad as each other, and therefore they will go with the one who offers a change from the status quo. We in Britain have a very positive view of Hillary Clinton. We forget how much her husband, although he was good at running an economy and widely respected as a political strategist, how much he degraded the White House and how he reduced the integrity of the presidency. So when you have journalists, newspapers attacking Trump for the things he had to say about women, most voters were listening to that and thinking, come on, Bill Clinton is the man who had sex in the Oval Office with an intern. It's because of Bill Clinton that people in the 1990s had to explain things to their children like oral sex and why a cigar shouldn't go in certain places or what does it mean to have semen on a dress. Bill Clinton did that, not Donald Trump. So people were very skeptical and cynical about a lot of the press negativity towards Trump. They believed that he was as bad as they said. They didn't doubt it. But they didn't care because politics had already been reduced to that level.
So, James, if this was the world's biggest ugly baby contest and Trump emerged that way, we've heard a lot of people in the Rust Belt states saying that they used to be Democrats, they're fed up with NAFTA, they're fed up with the jobs being exported. There is a certain constituency who believe that they've been overlooked by the Democratic establishments, by conventional politics, and they now expect Trump to help. Now, do you see them becoming just as disillusioned and angry in a few years' time when it turns out that McDonald isn't likely to re-industrialise those states any more than Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama?
Yeah, look, I think this is the big question. Can he actually deliver for the people who voted for him? Can he deliver the kind of change that they want? And I think there are very good reasons, as you say, to be sceptical about whether he can. I think we do have to think where that anger goes if you elect this ultimate outsider, this guy who's never held elected office before, and still things stay the same. I mean, that will cause a lot of anger. I think what the Democrats suffered from in this election, though, is a kind of message to the left worldwide, which is in the advanced world, left-wing parties face this tension, which is they have two parts to their coalition. One is metropolitan, highly educated, pro-immigration, pro-globalisation, pro-multiculturalism coalition, and the other is the old industrial working class, who are generally not in favour of those things. And that, I think, that tension, you know, you see it in these results in these elections, where Hillary Clinton does remarkably well in metropolitan cities, but loses these Rust Belt states. And I think that is a danger for the Labour Party in this country. You saw it with the Brexit result, that divergence between London Labour and Northern Labour. And I think, you know, it is also an issue for the French Socialists ahead of their presidential elections next year. You know, how do left-wing parties resolve this contradiction?
Now, Tim, I imagine much will depend now on what kind of president Donald Trump is going to be, whether he's going to be a laid-back Reagan-esque president, Reagan-esque only insofar as he just might choose decent people to fill his cabinet and leave them to it. Is that, do you think, the most we can hope for at the moment?
That is what everyone is predicting. If you look at the detail of the policy that Trump pushed that wasn't his own, i.e. his own stuff about building a wall or stopping Muslims from coming into the country, it was boilerplate Republican on healthcare, on tax and spend, on education. I can see him farming a lot of the responsibility out to the GOP, and in particular to Mike Pence and probably also Chris Christie. So I think we can expect business as usual. I do expect him to be Reagan-esque in this regard. Sometimes rhetoric is important, and Reagan simply saying it's morning in America made people feel like it was morning in America, even though the country actually went through two recessions under his leadership. Likewise, I noticed when traveling the country that Trump's constant positivity about the United States, make it great again, wonderful country, it's exceptional, actually struck a chord with people. Barack Obama lectures and hectors the public. He's always telling them to calm down and stop getting things wrong. Donald Trump, I can see spending the next 8 years being a sort of booster for the morale, a cheerleader for the United States. And if he does that, I think that will actually overcome any difficulties that he suffers.
So, James, Donald Trump as the nation's cheerleader, interesting mental image. What do you think Donald Trump will do for America's role in the world? And ought we to be worried here that we've just seen the beginning of the end of NATO, because he's no great fan of NATO?
Well, Donald Trump, in global terms, Donald Trump will make George W. Bush look like the winner of the world popularity contest. He is going to be a bogeyman in Europe and in many other parts of the world. You saw this in, I think, Angela Merkel's quite remarkable message, basically saying that she was prepared to work with Donald Trump as long as he respected fundamental democratic values. I mean, you know, that is unprecedented for a...
And what did she have in mind there?
She says kind of respect, equality under the law, respect for minorities and the like. Now, what does he mean in terms of America's global role? Well, I think on NATO, he is going to insist that European countries pay their 2%. You know, if you look at 2% of GDP on defence, if you look at the numbers, I think it's 1.2% in Germany, 1.1% in Italy, under 1% in Spain. So I think he is going to make them pay their way. I think that is quite clear. Although I do think, and I think you also are going to see Vladimir Putin test him early on. You're going to see Vladimir Putin see how committed is he to the defence of Eastern Europe and the Baltic Republics. I think it will have a particular impact on Brexit for two reasons. First of all, the security guarantees that Britain is able to offer the Baltic republics and the Eastern European states are far more important now than they were before because of this uncertainty about America. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that before Trump's election, people used to, Brexit's critics say, oh, it's going to leave Britain isolated on the world stage. You can't really claim that when the president-elect of the most powerful country is an enthusiast. Indeed, he's more of an enthusiast for Brexit than the British Prime Minister. He was in favour of it before the referendum and she wasn't.
So, Tim, what upsides do you see to the Trump presidency?
I, on a personal note, I am very happy that we have a president who wants to reset the agenda with Russia. I was worried if Hillary had won that we would have found ourselves in an unnecessary conflict with Russia when we share the same strategic goals when it comes to dealing with terror. I think that's a positive. I think it's a positive that you're going to see a rhetorical shift. As I say, I think that might translate into a better mood across the country. And I also see a positive in terms of we're going to see the institutions of America tested for the next 8 years. History shows that whenever you have a president who tries to overextend himself, the legislature does the same and tries to catch up. That happened with Nixon and Watergate. It happened with Reagan and Iran-Contra. If Trump goes too far, we will see Congress and we will see the courts coming into play and trying to assert their own authority. That cannot be a bad thing. And one final thing, in the last 48 hours or so, we've seen the best in American politics. The campaign was American politics at its ugliest and most divisive. But in the last 48 hours, from Trump's very presidential acceptance speech, winning victory speech, to Barack Obama meeting him at the Oval Office, we've seen Trump graduate from a candidate to a president-elect, and we've seen the institutions kick in, and we've seen Americans pulling together. So ignore the stories of riots in New York. Ignore all the wailing on Twitter. America has a new president. It will come to terms with it. And I actually have faith that the country's institutions are big enough even to contain an ego like Donald Trump's.
But James, the concern that will linger with many Americans, let alone Europeans, is Trump's temperament. I mean, the exit polls showed that most people who voted, even those who voted for Trump, think he lacked the temperament to be president. That's a fairly major thing, isn't it? This is a man who, during the last days of his campaign, had his Twitter account rescinded by his staff because he couldn't be trusted with it. Now he's going to have his finger on the nuclear button. So how concerned should we be about the Trump temperament?
I was reading one of those kind of wonderful TikTok accounts that American journalists produced straight after the presidential campaign, where they've interviewed people on both sides about the campaign and the key moments in the Washington Post. And what I thought was most revealing was that these people who are Trump's, you know, closest aides, speaking on the record, kept describing incidents where they went to him and said, look, you've got to stop doing this. This is counterproductive. And how hard it was to contain him from doing things that were clearly harmful to his campaign. That, I think, is the question about him. Is he capable of doing that? Is he capable of, as Churchill would say, in victory magnanimity? Is he capable of staffing his administration, not just from those who were supporters of him during the campaign, but reaching out to those Republicans who were deeply sceptical of him, people who didn't back him? I think that is kind of one of the big questions about Trump. Is he able to recruit the best people for jobs, putting aside his personal issues with them? And also, is he capable of not getting involved in the kind of silly, demeaning spats that so characterised the campaign? Is he capable of having kind of mature relations with world leaders, even those who've been critical of him? Is he able to send out a genuine message of unity? Is he able not to kind of pick on people, which I think is one of the least appealing aspects of his character? I think we kind of will see all of that. I think one of the other absolutely intriguing things about Donald Trump as well is the importance of family to him. Reading these accounts of the campaign, it becomes quite clear that the kind of the hired hands had nothing like the influence on him that his own family had. That it is quite clear that when they wanted to get things done, they went to his daughter, Ivanka, or Donald Trump Jr. Mm. and tried to persuade them to persuade him.
So do you think his family is going to be a lot more influential then in his presidency than the family of other presidents?
Yes, and I think one of the fascinating things with foreign governments is, you know, everyone knows how to form relations with secretaries of state or whatever, but if the people who really have the president's ear are his own flesh and blood, how do you get in with them? You know, how does the British government open up a line of communication to Ivanka Trump, for example?
Prince Harry?
No, but you know, this is one of the intriguing questions. Of, I think it is such a challenge to all the diplomats in the British Embassy in Washington and to Downing Street in the Foreign Office. How do you do this? I do think it is quite interesting that Boris Johnson and Mike Pence, the new vice president, who I think will be one of the more powerful vice presidents in recent history, have already talked. I think that kind of thing could be quite a big deal.
And of course, Boris Johnson was on record a while ago saying that the reason he wouldn't go to New York was a very real risk of bumping into Donald Trump. This was in retaliation to some rude things Trump was saying about Britain. Do you think Trump is going to forget and forgive all the rude things which pretty much, not quite every world leader, but a lot of world leaders have said about him? And also with Nicola Sturgeon today, she's saying that as Scottish First Minister, she's going to pride herself on being the only government leader who's going to be rude to Donald Trump throughout of this. So how do you think that the other world leaders will deal with this now? I mean,
I think it's fascinating. I mean, the French and the German world leaders are going to use Trump as a domestic punch bag because they've got elections next year.
Right.
And so
always being anti-American always works in France anyway. It will doubly work.
And I think that you will see both Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande kind of constantly kind of tacking against Trump, partly because they think it will energise their own base, partly because he represents what they fear in their own countries. In France, there is the fear of Marine Le Pen, and to Angela Merkel, it is this fear that the liberal European order is becoming undone.
Yeah,
I think Trump is going, I mean, logically, I think he is going to have to be prepared to forgive and forget because virtually no one has been nice about him. I mean, you know, he is going to be a fairly friendless chap on the world stage if he isn't prepared to do that. So we'll have to see. But I think this comes back to the point I was saying earlier. You know, is he capable of in victory magnanimity?
Well, I guess for the next few days and months, we'll find out. James Forsyth and Tim Stanley from The Daily Telegraph, thank you very much. And thanks for listening to this podcast. You can subscribe to it, if you like it, on the iTunes Store. And also do consider subscribing to our politics podcast, Coffee House Shots. Thanks for listening. I'm Fraser Nelson.